Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. On today's episode, you know what I've done? Do you know what I've done? I've done the thing. The thing that I do sometimes. I've forgotten to open up my pages. On today's episode, we will be discussing Book 5, Chapter 4, Part 1 of The Brothers Karamazov, and then reading the second half, Part 2 of Book 5, Chapter 4. And now my phone decides to go ba-ding. I apologize for that. Ignore that. Thank you. Silence phone. So, Einstein said, Dostoevsky gives me more than any scientist, more than Gauss. Ivan says that God created everything according to Euclid's geometry. But some philosophers don't think so. Then, we are limited tri-dimensional beings trying to understand God in different dimensions. Gauss was a German mathematician who worked in a new geometry of curvature of surfaces. So Einstein reckons that Dosto was awesome. Everyone reckons Dosto is awesome, even Einstein. And here I am, complaining and moaning day after day about how much he sucks. By this point, I am forced to consider that maybe it's me that has the problem. Maybe Dosto is actually really great and I just don't get it. That could be it. I was in a bad mood yesterday and I said something to that effect on the discussion forum. Just saying, you know, sorry guys, if the podcast was crappy, had a rough day, that kind of thing. And I got a lot of comments, which I won't read because it's really got nothing to do with the book, but Techrific, Uncle Drosselmeyer, Soma Stars, Swim Said the Mama Fishy, Brian E. Denton, and Starfall15 all said really nice things in response, just basically saying, like, they hope I'm okay, and that kind of thing. So, to those guys I just named, thank you so much for that. When I woke up this morning and I saw those messages of support just saying, you know, we hope you're okay, it actually did mean a lot, so... yeah, I appreciate you guys. Swim Said the Mama Fishy. Oh, wait, before I go into these comments, I should read the questions that I asked you guys. This chapter was pretty grim, is pretty grim so far. What are your thoughts on that? It was a very violent thing. What are all these crazy violent anecdotes about? And also general comments, please. Oh, I've got the hiccups. Excuse me. It's the worst time to get the hiccups when you're, trying to do a podcast. The last question, general comments. As you can see, I was feeling a little bit stumped, uninspired to come up with a third question. Swim Said the Mama Fishy said, I've always liked this quote. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time. Churchill. Techrific said, Ivan is really no materialist, or if he is a very poorly educated one. Empathy starts with our family and extends out by proxy. When Ivan says that he doesn't love his neighbour, up close, but only in the abstract, he's echoing the revolutionary movements of his time. This is exactly the kind of thinking that led to the bloody revolutions in France and later in Russia. Those doctrines loves mankind in the abstract, but can kill individuals indiscriminately precisely because they could not love them up close. This thinking is the one that leads to civil war where neighbours kill neighbours for some abstract idea like Marxism or Leninism or international socialism or anarchism or fascism, Nazism, or even religious beliefs. These ideas still have a lot of drawing power for scared, bitter and downtrodden people. What starts off as a revolution for the people usually turns very bloody, and then one group of leaders are replaced by another. And people remain precisely where they began, but with deep wounds that may take generations to heal. The whole exercise is futile because it's built on totalitarian thinking. These movements can't look beyond power and production and therefore miss the complexities and the nuances of the democratic system, however inadequately, do capture and nurture. Democracies are vulnerable precisely because they can see the complexities and the nuances of human life, and that's why it is so important to fight totalitarian ideas, whether they're coming up from the left or the right. The mediocre centre may feel and seem unsatisfactory, but it works better than the alternatives. The mediocre centre. I am Norwegian, said those are some very good points. I'm surprised by how similar your thoughts are to mine on those that are so willing to kill for their beliefs. I don't buy into the platitudes people usually throw around democracy, but democracies are very good at digging deep roots. It's a stable system that fosters debate and discussion. Many people complain about just how bad democracies are at translating the will of the people into policy and structure, but this is also good because then society is not swept away in the currents of fashionable thought or reactionary thinking, but slow, hard-fought progress is how we think is often enshrined. This is stupidly oversimplified, of course. Often bad policy is enacted, and the state of public discord is nothing to swoon over, but in comparison to totalitarian states, I think I'm being accurate. If you're interested in why people act like they do in democracies, The Myth of the Rational Voter is an incredible book. It explains why people treat policies as a tribal sport, why people are so unwilling to delve into the schools of thought necessary to choose good policies, and the main biases that shape people's stance on economic policies. Wow, cool, interesting stuff. I Am Norwegian said, it's been a consistent theme so far, loving humanity in the abstract, but not man in particular, and Ivan continues it here. It's a sort of passive love that frees you from having to do anything at all, and even if you feel compelled to do something, it can quickly turn into a corrupted form of love, the lacerations Ivan mentions in this chapter, and the prideful, noble love Katrina has for Dimitri. I don't have anything insightful to say about this, but I think it is interesting. It's not something I've thought about since the Friends episode, where Phoebe and Joey debate the possibility of a selfless good deed after Joey joins a charity event as a phone operator. Phoebe argues that it's not selfless since it makes you feel good, making it instead a cynical thing. It's been at least 15 years since I watched the episode, so I have no idea why I remember it, but it's stuck in my mind. Now you're kind of speaking on my level, I Am Norwegian. If we could just go ahead from here and try to analogize, is that the word I want? Just relate everything back to like a pop culture reference for me, or a sitcom especially, then maybe I'll be following a little bit better. I Am Norwegian said, the chapter was very grim. I was struck by how similar Ivan's story of the cruelty mirrored what we read of the Japanese in China during the Nanjing Massacre, or what the Cambodians suffered at the hands of the Khmer Rouge. Not that Dostoevsky had any special insight into the future. To quote every poor writer of video games and movies the last decade, war never changes. The story of Richard was interesting too, in one way the tale of salvation, but in another a very peculiar and twisted tale that leaves a bad taste in the mouth. I wonder what Zosima would have to say about it. All in all, a very interesting half chapter. I think I'm beginning to understand Ivan better with his collection of macabre tales. Macabre. Uncle Zosima said, in XIX, 19, and even for many people today, all our sufferings are justified as part of an intelligent plan God has for his creation that as humans we are unable to understand. Ivan thinks otherwise. I think he implies that our sufferings are meaningless in the big scheme of things. The universe seems running on autopilot with the absence of God, and we are the victims of other people's whims. Ivan says he loves the creation, the humanity, but he cannot love any particular man but he cannot love any particular human being because history has proved we own a sophisticated cruelty. He loves life, but he doesn't love God's plan, if any. Every anecdote is needed to prove his point. Brian E. Denton said, I have... Ivan keeps a notebook full of anecdotes of horrible humanity. I actually keep one too. I call it hashtag man is a savage beast. And it's full of stuff from all the history books I read. I don't follow Ivan into misanthropy, though. At least I don't think I do. Not yet, anyway. Techrific said, whoops, sorry. Techrific said, that sounds like a subreddit waiting to happen, Brian. I enjoyed your series of tweets today. Yeah, I read that little series of tweets today as well, Brian, and I found it quite funny. I especially liked it. You said something like, imagine if Ivan had Twitter, which I found pretty funny. Spitflame said, this chapter is probably the best argument for atheism ever written. Basically, it doesn't matter if evil is justified, just as we can know what is good. No moral person would torture a small child just to ensure paradise, which is what Ivan asks Alyosha. I think the best way to overcome the suffering in life is to act out your religious ethic. It doesn't matter if Alyosha loses the argument because how he acts will be what's relevant in the end, which in turn can inspire others to do the same. Ivan is definitely the most fascinating character. I also kind of feel bad for him, since he's very unhappy due to his own overly rational way of thinking. You won't find peace if you demand a rational explanation for everything, because history and human nature is fundamentally irrational. Terrific, timely little reminder about the story of Isaac. Ahem, story of Isaac, that's precisely what God asks of Abraham. Abraham? Abraham. The fact that he was willing to do that shows how belief is dangerous. It corrupts our thinking. If God commands it, it's moral by default. That is a problem whichever way you turn it. It's an inescapable, unescapable, pesky problem. There's a book called Fear and Trembling by Soren Kierkegaard, which focuses on the story of Isaac and Abraham's leap of faith that he takes there in an existential argument. It's pretty interesting. Laura Y. Stitch said, have you guys read 1984? The story of Richard reminded me of the end of 1984. I don't want to say more because of spoilers. Okay. Be spoilers for 1984 or spoilers for this book? Because I've read 1984. But I don't know what you're referring to there. Well, anyway. That's it for the conversation section of this podcast. Now let's read the second half of... what were we reading? Book 5, Chapter 4, which goes a little bit like this. A well-educated, cultured gentleman and his wife beat their own child with a birch rod, a girl of 7, I have an exact account of it. The papa was glad that the birch was covered with twigs. It stings more, said he, and so he began stinging his daughter. I know for a fact there are people who at every blow are worked up to sensuality, to literal sensuality, which increases progressively at every blow they inflict. They beat for a minute, for 5 minutes, for 10 minutes, more often more savagely. The child screams. At last the child cannot scream, it gasps, Daddy, Daddy. By some diabolical, unseemly chance, the case was brought into court. A counsel is engaged. The Russian people have long called a barrister's a conscience for hire. The counsel protests in his client's defence. It's such a simple thing, he says. An everyday domestic event, a father corrects his child. To our shame, be it said, it is brought into court. The jury, convinced by him, give a favourable verdict. The public roars with delight that the torturer is acquitted. Ah, pity I wasn't there. I would have proposed to raise a subscription in his honour. Charming pictures. But I've still better things about children. I've collected a great deal about Russian children, Alyosha. There was a little girl of 5 who was hated by her father and mother, most worthy and respectable people, of good education and breeding. You see, I must repeat again, it is a peculiar characteristic of many people, this love of torturing children and children only. To all other types of humanity, these torturers behave mildly and benevolently, like cultivated and humane Europeans. But they are very fond of tormenting children, even fond of children themselves in that sense. It's just their defenselessness that tempts the tormentor. Just the angelic confidence of the child who has no refuge and no appeal. that sets his vile blood on fire. In every man, of course, a demon lies hidden, the demon of rage, the demon of lustful heat at the screams of the tortured victim, the demon of lawlessness let off the chain, the demon of diseases that follows on vice, gout, kidney disease, and so on. This poor child of five was subjected to every possible torture by those cultivated parents. They beat her, thrashed her, kicked her for no reason till her body was one bruise. Then they went to greater refinements of cruelty, shut her up all night in the cold and frost in a privy, and because she didn't ask to be taken up at night, as though a child of five sleeping its angelic sound sleep, could be trained to wake and ask. They smeared her face and filled her mouth with excrement, and it was her mother did this, and that mother could sleep, hearing the poor child's groans. Jesus, what is Dostoe trying to do to us here? Soldier on. Can you understand why a little creature who can't even understand what's done to her should beat her little aching heart with her tiny fist in the dark and the cold, and weep her meek, unresentful tears to dear, kind God to protect her? Do you understand that, friend and brother, you pious and humble novice? Do you understand why this infamy must be and is permitted? Without it, I am told, man could not have existed on earth, for he could not have known good and evil. Why should he know that diabolical good and evil when it costs so much? Why, the whole world of knowledge is not worth that child's prayer to dear, kind God. I say nothing of the sufferings of grown-up people. They have eaten the apple, damn them, and the devil take them all. But these little ones, I am making you suffer, Alyosha. You are not yourself. I'll leave off if you like. Never mind, I want to suffer too, muttered Alyosha. One picture, only one more, because it's so curious, so characteristic, and I have only just read it in some collection of Russian antiquities. I've forgotten the name. I must look it up. It was in the darkest days of serfdom at the beginning of the century, and long live the liberator of the people. There was in those days a general of aristocratic connections, the owner of great estates, one of those men, somewhat exceptional, I believe, even then, who, retiring from the service into a life of leisure, are convinced that they've earned absolute power over the lives of their subjects. There were such men then, so our general settled on his property of 2,000 souls, lives in pomp, and domineers over his poor neighbours as though they were dependents and buffoons. He has kennels of hundreds of hounds and nearly 100 dog boys, all mounted and in uniform. One day a serf boy, a child of 8, threw a stone in play and hurt the paw of the general's favourite hound. Why is my favourite dog lame? So he is told that the boy threw a stone that hurt the dog's paw. So you did it. The general looked the child up and down. Take him. He was taken from his mother and kept shut up all night. Early that morning the general comes out on horseback with the hounds, his dependents, dog boys, and huntsmen all mounted around him in full hunting parade. The servants are summoned for their edification, and in front of them all stands the mother of the child. The child is brought from the lock-up. It's all gloomy, cold and foggy, autumn day, a capital day for hunting. The general orders the child to be undressed. The child is stripped naked. He shivers, numb with terror, not daring to cry. Make him run, commands the general. Run, run, shout the dog boys. The boy runs. At him, yells the general, and he sets the whole pack of hounds on the child. The hounds catch him and tear him to pieces before the mother's eyes. I believe the general was afterwards declared incapable of administering his estates. Well, what did he deserve? To be shot? To be shot for the satisfaction of our moral feelings? Speak, Alyosha. To be shot, murmured Alyosha, lifting his eyes to Ivan with a pale, twisted smile. Bravo, cried Ivan, delighted. If even you say so, you're a pretty monk. So, there is a little devil sitting in your heart, Alyosha Karamazov. What I said was absurd, but... That's just the point, that but, cried Ivan. Let me tell you, novice, that the absurd is only too necessary on earth. The world stands on absurdities, and perhaps nothing would have come to pass in it without them. we know what we know. What do you know? I understand nothing, Ivan went on, as though in delirium. I don't want to understand anything now. I want to stick to the facts. I made up my mind long ago not to understand. If I try to understand anything, I shall be false to the fact, and I have determined to stick to the fact. Why are you trying me? Alyosha cried, with sudden distress. Will you say what you mean at last? Of course, I will. That's what I have been leading up to. You are dear to me. I don't want to let you go, and I won't give you up to your Zossima. Ivan, for a minute, was silent. His face became all at once very sad. Listen, I took the case of children only to make my case clearer. Of the other tiers of humanity with which the earth is soaked from its crust to its centre, I will say nothing. I have narrowed my subject on purpose. I am a bug, and I recognise in all humanity that I cannot understand why the world is arranged as it is. Men are themselves to blame, I suppose. They were given paradise, they wanted freedom, and stole fire from heaven, though they knew they would become unhappy. So there is no need to pity them. With my pitiful earthly Euclidean understanding, all I know is that there is suffering and that there are none guilty, that cause follows effect, simply and directly, that everything flows and finds its level. But that's only Euclidean nonsense. I know that, and I can't consent to live by it. What comfort is it to me that there are none guilty and that cause follows effect simply and directly, and that I know it? I must have justice, or I will destroy myself, and not justice in some remote infinite time and space, but here on earth, and that I could see myself. I have believed in it. I want to see it, and if I am dead by then, let me rise again, for if it all happens without me, it will be too unfair. Surely I haven't suffered simply that my crimes and my sufferings may manure the soil of the future harmony of somebody else. I want to see, with my own eyes, the hind lie down with the lion, and the victim rise up and embrace his murderer. I want to be there when everybody suddenly understands what it has all been for. All the religions of the world are built on this longing, and I am a believer. But then there are the children, and what am I to do about them? That's a question I can't answer. For the 100th time, I repeat, there are numbers of questions, but I've only taken the children, because in their case what I mean is so unanswerably clear. Listen, if all must suffer to pay for the eternal harmony, what have children to do with it? Tell me, please. It's beyond all comprehension why they should suffer, and why they should pay for the harmony. Why should they, too, furnish material to enrich the soil for the harmony of the future? I understand solidarity in sin among men. I understand solidarity in retribution, too. But there can be no such solidarity with children. And if it is really true that they must share responsibility for all their father's crimes, such a truth is not of this world and is beyond my comprehension. Some jester will say, perhaps, that the child would have grown up and have sinned, but you see, he didn't grow up, and he was torn to pieces by the dogs at 8 years old. Oh, Alyosha, I am not blaspheming. I understand, of course, what an upheaval of the universe it will be when everything in heaven and earth blends in one hymn of praise, and everything that lives and has lived cries out loud, Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed. When the mother embraces the fiend who threw her child to the dogs, and all three cry aloud with tears, Thou art just, O Lord, then, of course, the crown of knowledge will be reached, and all will be made clear. But what pulls me up here is that I can't accept that harmony, and while I am on earth, I make haste to take my own measures. You see, Alyosha, perhaps it really may happen that if I live to that moment, or rise again to see it, I, too, perhaps may cry aloud with the rest, looking at the mother embracing the child's torturer. Thou art just, O Lord. But I don't want to cry aloud then. While there is still time, I hasten to protect myself, and so I renounce the higher harmony together. It's not worth the tears of that one tortured child who beat itself on the breast with its little fist and prayed in its stinking outhouse with its unexpiated tears to dear kind God. It's not worth it because those tears are unatoned for. They must be atoned for, or there can be no harmony. But how? How are you going to atone for them? Is it possible? By their being avenged? But what do I care for avenging them? What do I care for a hell for oppressors? What good can hell do since those children have already been tortured? And what becomes of harmony if there is a hell? I want to forgive, I want to embrace, I don't want more suffering, and if the sufferings of children go to swell the sum of sufferings which was necessary to pay for truth, then I protest that the truth is not worth such a price. I don't want the mother to embrace the oppressor, who threw her son to the dogs. She dare not forgive him. Let her forgive him for herself, if she will. Let her forgive the torturer for the immeasurable suffering of her mother's heart, but the sufferings of her tortured child has no right to forgive. She has no right to forgive. She dare not forgive the torturer, even if the child were to forgive him. And if that is so, if they dare not forgive, what becomes of harmony? Is there in the whole world a being who would have the right to forgive and could forgive? I don't want harmony. From love for harmony, I don't want it. I would rather be left with the unavenged suffering. I would rather remain with my unavenged suffering and unsatisfied indignation, even if I were wrong. Besides, too high a price is asked for harmony. It's beyond our means to pay so much to enter on it. And so I hasten to give back my entrance ticket, and if I am honest, an honest man, I am bound to give it back as soon as possible. And that I am doing. It's not God that I don't accept, Alyosha, only I most respectfully return him the ticket. That's rebellion, murmured Alyosha, looking down. Rebellion? I am sorry you call it that, said Ivan earnestly. One can hardly live in rebellion, and I want to live. Tell me yourself. I challenge your answer. Imagine that you are creating a fabric of human destiny, with the object of making men happy in the end, giving them peace and rest at last, but that it was essential and inevitable to torture to death only one tiny creature, that baby beating its breast with its fist, for instance, and to found that edifice on its unavenged tears. Would you consent to be the architect of those conditions? Tell me, and tell me the truth. No, I wouldn't consent, said Alyosha softly. And can you admit the idea that men for whom you are building it would agree to accept their happiness on the foundation of the unexpiated blood of a little victim, and accepting it would remain happy forever? No, I can't admit it, brother, said Alyosha suddenly. Brother, said Alyosha suddenly, with flashing eyes, you said just now, is there a being in the whole world who would have the right to forgive and could forgive, but there is a being, and he can forgive everything, all and for all, because he gave his innocent blood for all and everything. You have forgotten him, and on him is built the edifice, and it is to him they cry aloud, Thou art just, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed. Ah, the one without sin and his blood. No, I have not forgotten him. On the contrary, I have been wondering all the time how it was you did not bring him in before, for usually all arguments on your side put him in the foreground. Do you know, Alyosha, don't laugh. I made a poem about it a year ago. If you can waste another 10 minutes on me, I'll tell it to you. You wrote a poem? Oh, no, I didn't write it, laughed Ivan, and I've never written 2 lines of poetry in my life. But I made up this poem in prose, and I remembered it. It was carried away when I made it up. You will be my first reader, that is, listener. Why should an author forego even one listener? Smiled Ivan. Shall I tell it to you? I am all attention, said Alyosha. My poem is called The Grand Inquisitor. It's a ridiculous thing, but I want to tell it to you. All right, there we go. Another chapter down, and I can see that the title of the next chapter is The Grand Inquisitor, so it looks like we're going to hear this poem of Ivan's, which he has committed to memory. All right. Have your say about this chapter, reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Yeah, cool. I look forward to seeing what you guys have to say, and thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.